This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Let's begin with this.
Space, the final frontier.
Ed Murphy is an astronomer at the University of Virginia, and he joins me live in studio with our update about all things space. How are you, sir? It's good to see you.
Good. How are you?
I'm very good. So let's start with the launch, I should say the final launch of the Space Shuttle. Is that right?
The Space Shuttle
tomorrow.
Discovery. That's right. The Space Shuttle Discovery is launching tomorrow afternoon at 4:50 p.m. on a mission to the International Space Station, and Discovery and her crew of six we'll be spending almost 2 weeks at the space station, bringing up a large module for the space station, conducting some spacewalks. And this will be the very last launch ever for Discovery, which is the most traveled, the most launched, the most famous of the three shuttles that are left.
So after it goes up there, how long are they going to be up there, and what happens to it when they bring it back?
So a little bit after, they'll be up there for about 2 weeks. They will bring it back home, and initially nothing will happen to it. It's going to go back to the Kennedy Space Center. And it will be kept there because there are two more shuttle missions on the books coming up. And so they need to keep Discovery around in case they need to scavenge it for spare parts or in case of an emergency. But at the end, the belief is that Discovery will end up at the Udvar-Hazy Center in Dulles. It's
The
National Air and Space Museum, that center that they built out near Dulles.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that new big center. So the NASA administrator still has to make the decision as to where the shuttles will go at the end of their life, but it's been widely reported that Discovery is headed for the I believe it's pronounced the Udvar-Hazy Center.
Okay, very good, Ed. That's impressive. I don't know if I could pull that one off.
I used to call it the Udvar-Hazy Center, but I just happened to be there this past weekend, and they kept correcting
us. That's the place with all the really big stuff, right, that just doesn't fit in the place in D.C.?
Yeah, they have a Boeing 707, a Concorde, an SR-71. It's
and you can go on these things or just look at them?
Just look at them.
You can't go in them?
They have some small ones you can go in, and then they have some simulators that my boys really liked.
Yeah. So the space shuttle launches tomorrow at 4:50. We have an opportunity to carry that live on this program, so we might do that.
Okay.
If we can fit it in. And this is really the end of an era, right?
It is. As I said, after the Discovery, then there are only two more missions on the books. And in fact, only one of those is funded. NASA, as with everyone on the federal government, is operating under a continuing resolution right now. And in the continuing resolution, there's only one more flight after Discovery. But Congress had asked them to include a third flight, another one that would happen over the summer. They just have to allocate the money for that one.
Yeah. And these things, are they safer because they were blowing up there for a while, weren't they? Well,
that's why we're retiring them, is that that when they looked at the space shuttle program after the Columbia accident, it was decided that they just can't be made safe enough to fly. We need to retire them and replace them with something more reliable that's safer.
So we're going back to what we saw growing up. More of the rockets that splash down in the ocean, right?
That's likely, although really we don't know what's coming up next, because NASA had a plan for a replacement for the space shuttle, but President Obama canceled that because it was so far behind schedule and so far over budget. And he favors letting commercial industry do this, finding some commercial providers who will launch our astronauts into space. Essentially, we just pay them to launch our astronauts for us. But right now, NASA is not developing a replacement for the space shuttle. They're relying on industry to do that. And until industry gets a rocket prepared, we're going to be launching our astronauts on the Russian Soyuz spacecraft.
It's 4:13 here in Charlottesville, 43 degrees. We're talking with Ed Murphy, astronomer from the University of Virginia. Ed, you and I have talked many times about this, and we're definitely on the same page that, you know, the emphasis shouldn't be in putting people up there, but in more of these robotics, because that's where we get really all the return in terms of science and knowledge and exploration.
That's right. You know, in the last few weeks, there have been some amazing science returns that have come out of our robotic missions that are flying around the solar system. The Kepler robot has discovered 1,200 potential planetary systems around other stars. Stardust visited its second comet and photographed it up close. And coming up in a few weeks, we have a spacecraft going into orbit around Mercury. And all of them are returning tremendous amounts of science back to us.
Now, what's the Kepler? That's like a floating telescope out there.
It's a floating telescope, and it stares at 155,000 stars all at one time. And it monitors them 24 hours a day. Continuously, and it looks for the dip in light from the star as a planet orbiting the star passes in front of the star. As the planet passes in front of it, it blocks out a little bit of light from the star, and that lets us know that there's a planet there.
Yeah, and it has discovered, what'd you say, over 1,200 possible planets?
That's right. In its first 4 months of operation.
Holy cow.
In early February, they announced that the possibility, now these are not confirmed, and the Kepler people are quite adamant about saying that these have not been confirmed yet, but they have 1,235 planetary candidates that have passed in front of their parent stars. Of those, based on how much the light dims, we can tell how big the planet is. 58 of them are about the size of the Earth. And of those 58 Earth-sized planets, 5 of them are in their habitable zones around the star. That's where liquid water could exist.
Holy cow. Now, where are these things? How far away are they?
They're anywhere up to about 3,000 light years away, anywhere from about 100 to about 3,000 light years away from us.
So there's no – they're not close at all. There's no – yeah. I mean, in terms of space, they're
nearby, close. Yeah. In terms of the space or
galaxy. But in terms
of,
even getting a robotics mission out there.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, no, because the nearest ones are hundreds of light years away, and the furthest we've ever sent a spacecraft, Voyager 1, is only 16 hours away from us by light travel time. So we won't be sending a probe to any of these planets in my lifetime or your lifetime.
But the significance is that the robotics in space is discovering the really strong possibility that there are indeed Earth-like planets out there.
That's right. And a year ago, it was big news when we would discover even one Earth-like planet in an orbit around a star where liquid water could exist. And what we're seeing out of Kepler now is that they're announcing them in batches of 5, and probably the next Kepler announcement will have many more.
Amazing. We're talking with Ed Murphy, astronomer at the University of Virginia. Before we take a break, you mentioned Stardust. What is that mission?
So Stardust is a spacecraft that was launched to go pass through the tail of a comet and put up what is literally a catcher's mitt. It was a large platter of glassy material. And as the spacecraft swept through the tail of the comet, little tiny particles of rock and ice would embed themselves in this glass. That glass was then folded up, put in a capsule, and returned to Earth. But the parent spacecraft was still out there. And they were trying to figure out what they should do with it. And they decided to send it to another comet that we had visited in 2005 called Tempel 1. And you might remember that mission. It's sort of every person's dream mission for a comet. They took a big copper spacecraft and they smashed it into the surface of Tempel 1. And it blew all this millions of kilograms of material off the surface of this comet in an effort to study comets and determine what they're made of. But they released so much dust in that impact that they never got a good look at the impact site afterwards to see how big a crater was left behind. And the size of the crater can tell us a lot about how tightly comets are packed. When we talk about comets, we're talking about dirty snowballs made of water, ice, and rock and dust.
Yeah.
And the question is, are they packed together like a really tight ice ball or just a really loose snowball? And the size of the crater could tell us something about that, but it was obscured by the impact and how much dust was released.
Now we got to send another camera up there.
So that's what we already had the camera up there, Stardust, and we were able to repurpose Stardust and send it back. And just last week, it flew past the comet. It was the first time humans had ever visited the same comet twice. It was separated by 5 years, or almost 6 years, the visits were separated. So we could also look for changes on the comet, and sure enough, there was the crater that we had made back in 2005. And the crater is about 150 meters, which is about 450 feet across.
Wow. Let's rejoin our conversation with Ed Murphy, astronomer from the University of Virginia. Ed, there's a space station pass tonight, right?
That's
right. It's going to be visible, you think?
It's right on the edge of visibility. That's because the sun sets tonight right around 6 o'clock, and the space station is passing over at 6:27. So it's bright enough that it'll probably be visible if those clouds disappear out there. They were breaking up as I was coming in. But if those clouds disappear and it gets dark, we should be able to see it pass overhead.
Yeah. And this is, remind folks the direction and the time here.
So what they want to do is go outside about 6:20 in the evening, and they'll let their eyes get adjusted to the light levels outside. Face due west.
Two hours from right now.
Okay. Yeah. And then look towards the west and look just above the treetops out there. And about 6:24 in the evening, they should see a bright star-like object, which is the International Space Station, moving from left to right, which is from west to north across the sky. It'll be highest up at 6:27. It'll be 40 degrees above the horizon, which is a little less than halfway up in the sky. and then it will disappear down in the northeast a few minutes later after that, right around 6:30.
So will it pass directly overhead, or will it stay in the western sky?
It's going to stay in the western sky, yeah. This one's not quite a good enough pass to go straight overhead.
Yeah. Now, who's up there?
Right now, there's a crew of six on the International Space Station. It's a very international crew right now. And interestingly, not only is there an international crew, but there's a whole fleet of spacecraft that are docked to the International Space Station right now. There's a giant Japanese module. There is two Russian Soyuz spacecraft, a Russian Progress resupply vehicle. And the Europeans just launched a giant resupply ship a few days ago that will be docking with the International Space Station tomorrow. So when Discovery shows up, the International Space Station will be a very busy place.
It's like that bar from Star Wars with these people from all, creatures from all over the universe getting together.
And in fact, this is the last time that all of these different vehicles will be docked to the International Space Station at the same time, since the shuttle is retiring.
Yeah.
And there is some hope that they will take one of the Russian Soyuz vehicles and actually back off the space station and take a picture of what's going on up there, because it's sort of a one-time photo opportunity to do this.
Yeah, they're having a big old space party.
Yeah.
Ed, what is Tyche and what's the controversy about this?
So last week, a couple astronomers from the University of Louisiana Lafayette announced that they had improved a study that they had done about 10 years ago that said they had evidence that there is a massive planet in our solar system out there where the comets are, you know, well beyond the orbit of Pluto. Astronomers think there's a giant cloud of comets called the Oort cloud of comets. And they believe that orbiting through the Oort cloud is a giant Jupiter-sized planet. And the reason they believe it's out there is we see these comets leaving the Oort cloud, and every now and then they come into the inner solar system. And astronomers have been wondering what disturbs them enough that it changes their orbits that they come into the inner solar system. And this group believes that the thing that's disturbing them is a giant Jupiter-sized planet, and they believe they have the statistical evidence to show that it is out there, and they even believe they know where it might be in the sky.
But it's based on no direct observation of this planet. It's just inferred upon the movement of other things in the solar system.
That's exactly right. And it's based on the motion of comets through the solar system, which there aren't that many of these long-period comets that stretch out to the Oort cloud. The statistics, many of the scientists who've looked at this don't think the statistics are robust enough to claim that the planet exists out there.
What does Ed Murphy think?
Ed Murphy doesn't believe that it's out there. Yes. And I will tell you that something else that troubles me about it is the name that we haven't even seen this thing. There's nothing but bare statistical evidence to show it there, but they've already given it a name. And that is always trouble to me when you announce it through the press and you give this fictional planet a name. So
these people down in Louisiana are eating some funny brownies.
I think they need to do more work. And the problem is that it may be, and I think this is what the case will be, is that the orbits of these comets, there's just not enough of these comets to statistically show whether there is a planet out there or not. But we do have a way to determine this. And it's interesting, the data may already be in hand. There was a sky survey done with an infrared NASA satellite called WISE, the Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer. In fact, one of the scientists on that mission is Mike Skrutsky here at the University of Virginia. And that mission spent a year and a half mapping the whole sky in infrared light. It literally just took picture after picture, and it mapped the whole sky. Parts of the sky it did twice. But if there is a Jupiter-sized planet out there, WISE will discover it. Now
it'll be in those pictures.
Be in those pictures. Now, the thing is, WISE surveyed the whole sky. They've got thousands upon thousands of images of the sky. That data is all here on the ground. In fact, just last week, they put the spacecraft to sleep because its mission was done. But it will take astronomers years to look through all that data. But if there is a big planet out there, that's the way we will discover it.
Why wouldn't telescopes just see it? Is it they're saying it's in some cloud?
No, it's the Oort cloud is a massive cloud of comets, probably trillions of comets that are out there at the edge of the solar system. So it's not that we can't see it because it's behind a cloud. It's just so far away from the sun that it is so dim that in visible light, it doesn't stand out. It would be so incredibly faint in visible light that we couldn't see it. But in infrared light, it will stand out because presumably it's much, much warmer than the cold background of space.
So that's going to be one of the first missions with this new data, is to look through and see if this planet is really there.
Yes. And in fact, there's so much data that they already have automated searches that are going through that data, and they're finding hundreds upon hundreds of new asteroids in our solar system that we didn't know about before.
Yeah.
They're learning lots about things beyond our solar system. But
that's why they're holding their breath down in Louisiana.
That's right. And in fact, they claimed in Louisiana that if it exists, it's in the WISE data.
Yeah.
And so we will see in the next year or two if Amazing. Surprise turns it
hey,
up.
Hey, Ed, before we let you go, we have some time. What is this about the return cycle uptick in the number of solar activity on the sun?
That's right. So the sun goes through an 11-year up-and-down cycle where it goes through a very active period with lots of sunspots and then a very quiet period with not many sunspots. And the sun has finally come out of its solar minimum, this quiet time where there were hardly any sunspots. We had expected it to come out over a year ago, and it just recently started coming out. So the solar minimum was unusually long and deep, meaning the sun was very quiet for a while. But it has definitely picked up. Just the other day, there were 60 sunspots on the sun, a couple big ones and many small ones.
And what exactly is a sunspot?
A sunspot is a magnetic storm on the sun, and it looks dark because it's cooler than the rest of the surface of the sun.
So it's just a solar storm.
It's a solar storm. It's a place where the magnetic fields get tangled, and because they poke out of the surface of the sun, those regions that they poke out of can't get heat from the center, can't get heat from the interior.
And they cool off.
And they cool off and they look darker than the rest of the sun.
And don't they blow photons like at the Earth?
They can blow huge solar flares. So because the magnetic field above these sunspots is tangled, sometimes those tangled fields can snap. And when they do that, they fling particles towards the Earth in a huge solar flare. And they can cause aurora, or if it was a major solar flare, they could cause damage to satellites or worse.
And of course, I guess one of the long-term interests in astronomy is does this cycling of sunspot activity, do we see any result of that in the human story, in history?
That's right.
Is there some correlation between sunspot activity and what happens on Earth?
That's right. That's one of the big questions that hasn't yet been answered is what is the effect of sunspots on life on Earth here? There's a famous episode a few centuries ago where there was a long period of time in the 1600s and 1700s when there weren't many sunspots on the sun at all, and the Earth went through a particularly cold cooling period at that time called the Maunder Minimum.
Yeah. And lots of wars as well.
Right. Yeah. It was a very difficult time in Europe because it would get very cold in the winter, much colder than it does in the winter today. And the question is, are those two coincidental? Did the Earth go through a cooling period at the same time the sun was at a minimum, or was the Earth's cooling caused by the solar minimum? And nobody knows the answer to that.
Yeah.
We haven't been able to come up with a cause and effect there.
Ed Murphy, astronomer at the University of Virginia. Ed, thank you for the update.
Oh, thanks for having
me. Take care.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SeavillePodcast.com for more.